You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made It Play Report. Our guest on this episode is Peter Bell. Peter, it's good to have you here.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for inviting me.
So the way the show begins is with one huge question, but it helps us start. Who are you? What do we need to know about the way you aspire to live, what you've done, the labels you wear? What do we need to know about you to start this conversation?
I actually don't consider myself a very exceptional individual. And when I thought about, you had fed me this question to contemplate a couple days ago. And when these questions come up, I tend to say, well, I'm just a normal middle-aged white dude who happens to have had some interesting experiences, I suppose. But who I am, there's a level of profundity associated with a question like that. And, I'm on a journey through life, probably three quarters through at this point. And, I still don't know who I am. I'm not like lacking in contemplativeness, but I guess maybe one of the problems is that being a winemaker for the last 32 years, when someone says, who are you? I instantly go to the, I am a winemaker.
Go to the label, and most people do.
Yeah, so that's what I do. And winemaking, as you know from a few other guests you've had on, is one of these professions that is more than just a job. It sucks you right in. And there's a huge pleasure aspect to it. And there's a very kind of blurry line between work and play, which is it's a horrible thing to brag about, and I'm not really bragging, but there, when you are making wine for a living, half the time you go, oh gosh, they're paying me money to do this thing that I would easily do for free. It's that much fun.
And if it's not fun, you get out.
Yeah. And I know that a lot of people aren't that lucky with their profession. So, they can't get out because they're, let's say you're on an assembly line and you need the money. Nobody enjoys assembly line work. I've known people who have gone psychotic on them.
Right. Would you use the term, you're just a normal white guy, middle-aged white guy? What does normal mean?
That's a good question. Probably I might want to withdraw that. I've had some interesting experiences in my life. I've lived in like seven different countries and two different hemispheres. And I've done a lot of traveling and had some really cool adventures when younger. And I've had a very successful 41-year marriage. So maybe I'm not normal.
Well, I think what you were saying when you said normal was that, I don't see myself as exceptional.
Probably not.
You don't hold myself in too high esteem. And it's kind of hard for us to talk about ourselves for fear that we will come off too much aggrandizing ourselves or too much putting ourselves down. It's very hard to feel just comfortable where we are.
Yeah, I agree fully with that. And that's, I guess, my biggest fear is to, one of the worst sins around is hubris to me. Right. And I don't want to ever fall into that. Oh, by the way, also, I'm partly Canadian. I would call myself Canadian, and Canadians are probably a little more self-deprecatory than Americans tend to be.
Yes, I think that's a fair statement. So Peter, you brought some music with you. What should we open the show with?
Well, let's start with, and I'm going to, do you mind if I give a little preamble to this one?
Go right ahead. Go right ahead. You can describe before or after, however you want.
Let's do before. So I am going to play some music throughout this show that most people have probably some familiarity with, especially if they're baby boomers. However, the first tune I ask you to put up is something that almost nobody would ever have heard before. And that's on purpose, but it is a very meaningful piece of music to me and a genre of music. So when I was 6 or 7 years old in the early 60s, my mother bought me a record on Smithsonian Folkways. of Pete Seeger playing banjo and singing Anglo-American ballads. And I think that was the first time I ever heard the banjo. It was way before Beverly Hillbillies and certainly before Bonnie and Clyde, the movie, where people heard Earl Scruggs for the first time. And I somehow thought that that was a really cool sounding instrument. My taste in banjo music has been refined since then. But one of my earliest dreams was actually to learn to play the banjo. This was when I was 6 or 7, and then teach my dog how to play the drums. And I was going to have a band. It didn't last long. The dog didn't have opposable thumbs and no capacity for music. And then he got hit by a car anyway. So that dream didn't last very long. And I kind of put the banjo out of my head for another 10 years, but it was still ticking back in there. And I was living in downtown Toronto. This is, you know, long before internet, of course. Had no real way of finding out what the banjo was all about. I knew I didn't like bluegrass particularly. That's the three finger style. But I sort of happened upon this method of playing that's called clawhammer. Have you ever heard of it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So it's an interesting way of striking the strings with the back of your fingernail. And it actually, it's a technique that's practiced in Western Africa, which it's thought that that actually came over with the slaves, that kind of technique. And it was adopted by Anglo people like me hundreds of years later. So I'm going to play back to this tune. I'm going to fire it up for you. It's by a American banjo builder called Jason Romero and his Canadian wife on guitar. And you know, it's an AABB format, so it'll be sound a little repetitive, but I just want your listeners to experience how different this is from, say, bluegrass music.
Sure. We'll play it now. Thank you. Thank you. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Play Report. Our guest on this episode is Peter Bell. So Peter, thank you for bringing a little bit of music history to us and with that clawhammer style playing. I've heard about it for years because I've known a number of banjo players, but I got more into it in the history of country music when they did some sections on the passing of music back and forth between Africa and Irish English traditions.
Oh, I love that.
It was fascinating. So where I'd like to go next in the show is, given the life that you value now, and you've lived in, what you said, seven different countries and two hemispheres, and but given the life that you value now, what did you have to learn to know what that is and to know how to try to live it?
The cliche would be to learn what your passion is and then follow your passion. And there's some truth to that, even though it's something that would be on a Hallmark greeting card, right?
But what was your passion and what did you have to do to really get clear about that?
I had to get a useless degree. My first degree was in anthropology, and it was interesting enough, but I felt I needed a degree, and it never really kind of turned me on, other than to be able to do some research into ethnomusicological stuff, which we've referred to. So getting out of university in 1980, I really had no idea what I wanted to do, and I spent four or five years working as a cabinet maker in downtown Toronto, woodworking. And I guess what happened was very serendipitous, because at that point I was spending a fairly large amount of time trying to decide intellectually what I wanted to do, and it just wasn't working. Okay, so I just, you could take quizzes and surveys of what your aptitudes are, and then, shadow various people, and nothing really worked for me until I discovered wine. I was 25 or so, and I took a wine appreciation course, and instantly this started stimulating me intellectually and, physically, of course, hedonically. And I thought, okay, I have no idea what I need to do in order to do this, but I decided for the first time in my life that this was something I was so passionate about that I have to become a winemaker. It was daunting, and it's much easier these days to become a winemaker than it was in the mid 80s.
When did you realize, when in this course or when in this process did you realize that you were unlocking a passion?
Right away, within a few months. Yeah. And I could, I could look back on my life and see some glimmerings of interest. As a teenager, I liked beer quite a lot, not excessively, but I was very interested in good beer and occasionally a good bottle of wine. My parents were sort of aspirational wine drinkers. You remember Matus Rosé?
Oh, yes.
That's what they drank. That was my first one, too. But I did, as a 17-year-old, I was in Cambridge, England, and I ended up at Cambridge University visiting, and I was dragged along to a German wine tasting. So this is sort of like a prescient at kind of experience. And I was interested enough in that I actually wrote down the names of all the wines. And, German wine labels are quite complicated. Yes. So it took up several pages. And I have that diary to this day. That was 1974 or 5, I think. And so I can look back and see, there were some moments here that were, kind of crystal ball episodes as to what I would be doing.
So how did you decide you were going to act on that passion? There wasn't a straight path. There's a straighter path now.
No, that's a good point. I made a few phone calls. I called the University of California at Davis. And remember, at this point, I'm Canadian through and through. And I said, well, what does it take to get into your wine program? And he said, well, someone like you, you might as well... I might as well tell you now, even if you do get in, you're going to have to cough up $20,000 up front to pay tuition, because non-Americans don't get a break. So I said, well, forget that. I have like $3,000. I would have been prepared to do it. But I went ahead and took summer school classes in chemistry and math and physics, because I knew that I would need that as a background. And then started meeting people. And unfortunately, I was meeting, this sounds a little bit creepy, but I was meeting people in the sales end of things.
Sure.
In downtown Toronto, and not, I wasn't meeting any winemakers, and I knew I wasn't, I didn't want to be a salesman. I used lapel pins as a metaphor for what the difference between salespeople and me, and they wore lapel pins and I wore t-shirts, and never the two shall meet, you know, kind of thing. So then my wife and I were, you know, we said, here's a chance to do some traveling. We were childless and mortgage free and didn't own a car and had saved up about $15,000. So we decided to quit our jobs. My wife was a librarian at the time. And
you're still in your 20s at this point.
Oh yeah, mid 20s. So we headed off around the world. We took a year long trip to probably 15 or 20 different countries. Starting off with a gig in Bordeaux, France, picking grapes. I had a couple of contacts and reached out. And that's, you know, that was something that a lot of younger people did then. So we showed up at this chateau with our backpacks and spent the next 3 weeks picking grapes. It was pretty brutal, hard work, but it was a lot of fun. And there were people from all over the world. And then at the completion of our trip, I spun that experience into an article, which I sold to Wine Tidings magazine, a Canadian publication. I think it's still going. And they actually paid me $150 for it. And I was using that as leverage to show, you know, potential institutions that I was serious about wine. Funny thing about that is that magazine, Wine Tidings, that issue, the cover story was about the Finger Lakes. And this is long before I knew anything about the Finger Lakes. I had never visited, and I came across this a few years ago and said, hey, it's an article about the Finger Lakes. That was a snapshot from the mid-80s. It's a lot different here now. But let's see. Then at the completion of our world trip, we found ourselves in Australia, and I found out that there were two universities there, which not only had wine science degree programs, but were kind of open to accepting foreign students without too much trouble. So I wrote letters to both of them, and only one got back to me. And I applied, and I used as much kind of persuasive tactics as I could think of, and they accepted me. And this was in the mid-80s. We just had our first kid. And it was a pretty dramatic undertaking to contemplate pulling up and moving to Australia. And it almost fell through because some bureaucratic stuff happened. But they said, you know, they called up one day and said, well, can you be here in a week? This was in March of 1986. And I was working as a brewer then at a startup microbrewery in Toronto. And I said, yes, I didn't even have to think about it. And I went in the next day and quit my job. We got out of our lease, and I jumped on a plane, started school there. I was about 29 at the time, I think. And my wife and baby followed 6 weeks later. And there, that began 4 years of living in Australia and getting my degree there.
Let's take another break for music. But
great.
And we'll come back to some of this, because there's more to this story.
Ah, yeah, there is. Once I start opening up.
Right. What should we play next?
Okay. I want to pick a song that I was a little too young to have experienced when it came out. In 1963, I was alive and I was aware of the Beatles at that point. But there is this beautiful song called Hello Stranger by a singer called Barbara Lewis. And when I came across it again, you know, a few years ago, I thought, this is one of the most gorgeous, sultry songs with elements of doo-wop in it. And doo-wop is, you know, doo-wop is a really cool American musical genre that, you know, started on the city streets in New Jersey when a bunch of people had no musical instruments and then had to use their voices as instruments. And it was so successful that it became, you know, part of a lot of pop songs. So this is Hello Stranger. Give it a listen.
Hello, stranger. It seems so good to see you back again. How long has it been?
It seems like a mighty long time. Chupa, chupa, my baby. Ooh.
It seems like a mighty long time. Oh, I'm so glad you stopped by to say hello to me. Remember, that's the way it used to be. Ooh.
It seems like a mighty long time. Chubop, chubop, my baby. Ooh. It seems like a mighty long time. Chubop, chubop, my baby. Chubop, chubop, my baby.
Oh. Because I still love you so, although it seems like a mighty long time. Chubop, chubop, my baby, ooh.
It seems like a mighty long time. Chubop, chubop, my baby. Chubop, chubop, my baby. Chubop, chubop, my baby.
I'm so happy that you're here at last. Oh,
you're listening to WRFI, Watkinsville, Ithaca, and this is the Made in Play Report. Our guest on this episode is Peter Bell. So Peter, my memory of that song was about a year after it came out when I started first grade. And the buses in rural Missouri had little radios on them, and they played WHB pop music out of Kansas City, Missouri, which was 70 miles away. So I used to know every song that came out between like 1964 and 1970, whenever I quit riding the bus. But yeah.
I love it. Yeah. Well, it was a different era back then. We're about the same age, and you know, that's when AM radio ruled the waves. There was essentially nothing on the FM band at all. And furthermore, you know, it was top 40. Every song was three and a half minutes or less, and they were in heavy rotation. But what's extraordinary is that, you know, looking back, how much musical creativity was blossoming from that, you know, early 60s right through to the early 70s. To the point where this sounds like an old cranky statement, I just don't think popular music today is anywhere near as interesting. And I'm open to new music, believe me, I'm not like locked into the past. But a song like Hello Stranger and some of the other stuff we'll be playing later in the interview are just so remarkable in that, you know, they're sui generis pieces of music that didn't really sound like anything else and never will sound like something else.
And you only get to invent pop music once.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we grew up with, was that invention process.
Uh-huh. As you mentioned, the AM band had a great capacity to travel hundreds of miles, unlike FM radio. So yes, you could tune into some ball game in Texas if you were in Louisiana and get it, listen at night. And that was kind of exciting.
Or we could get Chicago or Memphis or, I know exactly what you mean. Let's go back to, let's pick up your story in Australia. in your becoming a winemaker, how did you, what did you have to do to kind of realize that passion? How did you have to evolve both as a person, as a parent, as a partner? How did you have to kind of, what did you have to do to bring that passion to a livable vocation?
It wasn't easy. Looking back there, you know, I have a lot of very fond, nostalgic memories of that, but we had to commit to a life of relative poverty. I think the most I ever made in 1 year living in Australia is about $12,000 to support a family of three. It didn't really matter because I was doing what I wanted to do. But, you know, sheer force of will, to answer your question, and having some confidence in myself. I had never paid attention in high school to anything to do with science. So I was kind of an English and languages guy. And the chemistry was kind of daunting. Organic chemistry is hard for almost everybody. But it's when you want to do it so badly, and it's relevant to your goal rather than this abstract kind of thing, you just do what it takes to have it happen. And, you know, once I got immersed in wine, it just felt so right. And I met all kinds of great people. Australians are very nice to other people and welcomed me right away. And I got to meet winemakers. I got to taste a lot of wine. I got to spend some time in the vineyard. And basically for the first time in my life, I felt this is what I need to be doing.
And how did that work out with your spouse and your child? And you know, how did those relationships play?
Overall, very well. I mean, my wife is, you know, I don't want to say long suffering because that's another cliche. She was on board with all this. And it's when you move to a new place with a baby, you can think of that as being sort of a stressful thing with lots of liabilities built in. But on the other hand, you know, when I was at school, she was taking our son to the park and immediately made a lot of friends with other mothers. And, you know, we did live hand to mouth, but we made some lifelong friendships. And she's almost more nostalgic for that 4 year period than I am.
Right. And I imagine that she had more unstructured time, even though more dependent time with the child.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, you guys chose to go on, you went on an adventure around the world, and then you went on an adventure halfway around the world.
Yeah, and that was this two of several. When I got out of high school, I went and lived in Europe for a year as a 18-year-old, and I decided I wasn't really ready for academia yet. And it was, I think, probably one of the best things I did as a young person. I just went and bummed around Europe and ended up getting a job in Spain on a sailboat just through a chance connection in Holland. I met a woman who said, you know where you should go? My son lives on a sailboat and he's looking for someone to help paint it. It was a charter yacht. So I said, okay. So after spending some time in Greece and Italy and Central Europe, I just showed up in this city called Tarragona on the coast of Spain and spent the next half year living on this boat and working on it. And I got a job teaching English and I got a job in a bar pouring drinks for Spaniards. So that was, sorry about the phone ringing in the background. Real life. Hang on, I'll just go turn it off. So that was way back when. And I went, after 2 years of in my first degree, I went and traveled around Northern Africa and Europe with a girlfriend for a year. So the whole adventure thing was sort of prime. I was primed for that anyway. And as a kid, I was sort of the academic equivalent of an army brat. My father was building his career. So I was born in Boston when he was getting his PhD at Harvard. And then we went off to Holland for a year and I learned to speak Dutch in third grade. Loved that. Came back and went to Berkeley, California for a year and then back to Lexington, Mass, and then Toronto. So I was familiar with and then very comfortable with living in various other places. So moving to Australia, you know, it was different because I was an adult, et cetera, but it didn't feel all that exotic.
There's a matter of factness to your travels, a matter of factness to your story. How did you come about that attitude?
I don't notice. I didn't notice that about myself. Tell me more. I mean, you're the observer.
It just kind of is what it is, and it's kind of evolved. But you know, it's like either you've told the story so often, or you're just so comfortable with it. You have had three or four major periods of travel in your life. Not a lot of people do that, but that seemed fine for you. You've made cabinets after. I mean, you and I share a degree in anthropology. I got one there, and
yay,
I figured other things out. And I ended up doing two other graduate degrees before I got things figured out. But it just seems to be that you wandered around the world until you found something that fit.
Yes, and I wasn't looking actively while wandering.
Right. You weren't worried about it. You don't seem stressed about it.
Oh, no. No, that doesn't really help. And it wasn't like I had a mandate to figure something out. I realized that I think it very rarely works for anybody, but I certainly would not have worked for me. So it does, you know, since you brought this up, it does seem like there's a very strong hedonistic element to this whole thing, this story. And I'm probably guilty of that.
Well, I mean, it kind of goes with the industry you're involved in.
Yes. Yeah, one interpretation is that I've spent my entire life chasing pleasure, and not only chasing it, but chasing it down and enjoying myself.
Right, right. But what I really respected about the story, and let me just tell you a little bit about mine. I grew up in rural poverty, and my ticket out was getting a full scholarship, getting paid to go to Cornell as an undergrad.
Nice.
But the thing is that to do that, I felt like I had to just push myself and keep pushing myself. And I did not know how to stop. And I didn't know what I was going to, but I knew what I was running from. So it had a very different feel. So when I hear you tell this story, and the hedonism that I saw in my classmates in the late 70s was, this was my ticket out. I wasn't going to blow it. But they were, you know, drinking and partying and having all this other stuff. They were truly obsessed with the hedonism, but they also had the skills that I didn't have to succeed academically.
Yes, isn't that interesting sociologically?
Absolutely. So you seem to have gone for the pleasure, but you didn't seem to be obsessed by it.
I suppose, yeah. I'm interested to hear your story because you had, you know, it was for you a ticket out of something. And I was born in a, you know, say middle class, comfortable middle class existence. And I, you know, my dad paid for my first degree. It was $1,200 a year tuition back then. So it wasn't a huge amount of money compared to these days, but I could sort of take that for granted. And I did, you know, during my summers, I painted houses for a living and saved all my money. So it's not like I was one of those Cornell kids. I know the ones you're talking about.
Right, right. But you didn't fret about it. You just did it. It sounds like it was fun for you.
It was. It was fun. I have to say.
It wasn't addictive fun. It was just fun.
Yes. Yeah, and that's, you know, it still applies to this day. One of the standard issue questions that you get as a winemaker when people interview you, you know, winemakers tend to be sort of quasi celebrities, so they get interviewed a lot. And one of the common questions is, if you were not making wine, what would you be doing? And most of the time people say, well, I would be, you know, teaching, or I would be on a farm, or I would be, you know, a minister. I've heard all these things. And all I can ever say when that question comes up is that I would be rueing the day I decided not to be a winemaker. There is no scenario other than winemaking that I know would be just as satisfying for me. Mm-hmm. It's just not there.
Right. Right. And I hear that. I also just sense from your story that if that door closed for reasons beyond your control, you would find another avenue.
Yeah, luckily it's a little bit late now. Even if the door closed, I'm so
close. No, I know. but that actually sets up a question. Well, let's cut to music again, and then I'll come back to my next question.
Okay, I'm going to pick another great 1960s pop song. This was on the radio in the summer of 1967 on the AM radio, blasted all over the place. A gorgeous piece by the Beach Boys called "Heroes and Villains." And you know, Brian Wilson was the genius behind the Beach Boys. In this case, he wrote the music, and a guy called Van Dyke Parks wrote some oddball lyrics. I chose this on purpose. You know, when you choose a Beach Boys song, you know you're leaving out about 50 other ones that are just as nice. And this one is an example of, you know, unleashed creativity in the 60s. Apparently, Brian Wilson was trying very, very hard to become as good as the Beatles and as popular as the Beatles. And he had just released Good Vibrations, which did very well. And this song for him was supposed to you know, rocket to number one and elevate him to the status of the Beatles. It didn't really work that way. Nevertheless, it's a fabulous song, and these calliope sounds, and it's got a lot of barbershop quartet going on and extraordinarily dense and creative harmonies, and it's just a joyous song. So let's listen to that.
I've been in this town so long that back in the city I've been taken for lost and gone and unknown for a long, long time. Fell in love years ago with an innocent girl from the Spanish and Indian home, home of the heroes and villains. Once at night, Cotillion Square, the fight, and she was right in the rain of the bullets that eventually brought her down. But she's still dancing in the night, unafraid of what it do.
Heroes and
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peter Bell. I have two different questions I'd like, and you can take them in whatever order you want. How has the life that you've lived put you in a position to change in ways that you wouldn't have anticipated or chosen? That's one way we often go at this point in the interview. The other way is, how has the impact of your wandering life up until you settled in winemaking, how has that played out in your family and your kids?
All right. Okay. I'll answer that one first. How about? So yeah, as of 30 years ago, I thought it looked like I was kind of committed to a peripatetic lifestyle, and then life changes and you find a career and raise children and buy a house. So as it happens, I've lived in the same part of the world for the last 30 years and in this very house for the last 25 years. That was imposed upon me. And it's not as if I said, well, my wandering days are over, because I have traveled a whole lot for work over the years. Mm-hmm. But I embrace that. There are times when it's appropriate to just, you know, throw a backpack on your back and hit the road, and other times when it's not appropriate to do that. My kids, one of them was born in Canada, one of them was born in Australia, and they both are pretty well traveled. My younger son went to university in Canada, and by the way, they basically never come back. We see him all that, fairly often, but he left home at age 17, and that was 2006, and he's been back maybe five times to visit. So,
you see him elsewhere.
Yeah, we see him elsewhere. So I don't know where I was going with that, but, winemaking is something that it is a fairly portable profession, and lots mm-hmm. of my younger colleagues have taken advantage of the fact that they can do two vintages in one year by bouncing between hemispheres, and it's pretty easy to get a work visa if you're under 30 years old, etc. So it's one of these professions that does allow you to keep traveling and moving around if you choose to do that. In my case, I chose to settle down, and here I am. Mm-hmm. What was your other question?
How have you changed in ways that you wouldn't have anticipated or necessarily chosen?
I'm around people that I didn't expect to be around. Okay. So I consider my colleagues in the Finger Lakes to be my tribe. Don't have any family here, and that's fine. They're elsewhere. I'm close to them, etc. But my winemaker colleagues are, and I are part of a big tribe, and we love each other and interact with each other all the time. Part of that tribe, in a more extended version, would be all the scientists I know, mostly from Cornell, but I know a lot of scientists. I've met a lot from around the world who are involved in wine, and they teach us all kinds of interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. I heard a statistic a couple months ago that most Americans cannot name one scientist. You know, this would be this so-called man on the street interview, and people go, I don't know. And maybe you think of Einstein or something, but I'm lucky enough I could rattle off 30 friends who are scientists. And that's, it's something that it changed me, being around really smart people with science backgrounds. It's changed the way I think about things. Has probably made me more intellectually acute.
And you couple that term science with the term tribe, which has almost a religious cultural quality to it.
I know, I don't mean it to be. I'm not a very mystical guy.
No, I'm not talking about mysticism. I'm talking about connection.
Connection.
Globally, and particularly in Europe, European West and US, we are largely disconnected.
Yes.
And yet we need 30 to 70 people in our lives with a significant roles in our lives to be sufficiently embedded in a community or a tribe that we have the redundancy of relationships that we can survive things that are bad, hard, good, celebrate with people we love, you know.
Absolutely. And it's very easy to just take that for granted when you have it. But if you were to absent those relationships, that's when, you know, people start having mental illness problems, right? You need that stasis.
Right. And from your story of growing up, I didn't hear about a tribe.
You did not?
Not in your story of growing up, not in your story of your early years.
No.
So much about a tribe, but I hear about it more later in life.
Yep. I mean, I do have a very nice extended family that I'm fond of. We interact now that they're on the other side of the border. Most of them, I haven't seen them since Christmas.
Right.
But we are, that is also my tribe. A lot of very close first cousins and things like that. But the ones I interact with, the ones that are sort of more central to my day-to-day existence here, are almost invariably part of the wine industry.
Right. And it was more of you're saying you grew up kind of like an army brat.
Yeah.
With the peripatetic lifestyle of following your father wherever he was going.
Yeah, I make friends easily, and as a kid, I never felt like ill at ease.
Right.
You know, plunking down in a new school in a new place, even if it was in Holland where I didn't speak any Dutch, I just managed to make friends pretty easily. And you know how easy it is for young people to learn a new language within a couple of weeks. I was speaking Dutch, and of course, I lost it all. And I wish that brain plasticity held on a little while longer. Right.
What about the quality of the ties of relationship now in your tribe? How is that different than you perceived it when you were in your late teens or 20s?
I think the friendships I have now are more profound, probably stronger. I'm still in touch with some friends from when I was much younger, but you know, those kind of friendships in high school, et cetera, tend to be sort of transitory.
Especially if you've switched schools a lot. I mean, the people I started first grade with are the people I graduated from high school with.
Wow.
We knew each other's stories. There are only 42 of us.
Uh-huh. And are you still in touch with some of them?
I'm in touch with some of them. Facebook is wonderful for that particular
Oh, is it ever?
Element.
Yeah.
But I have no immediate family within 70 or 80 miles of where I grew up.
Right.
Farming was just falling apart. And it was a rural ghetto in many ways. One out of 20 of my peers, 5 years older, 5 years younger, wouldn't make it to the age of 20 because of drugs or alcohol, accidents, suicides, fights with cops, bad health care. You know, rural America was suffering back in the 70s, and we don't.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of that still going on with the opioids which is very bizarre to me. It still pains me to know that this is nominally the richest country in the world, and we have such a high poverty rate, and there seems to be a lot of indifference to that fact, and a high incarceration rate, which is seen as normal. I could go on. I have a few complaints about this country.
Right, and I do too. But for me, the complaint track doesn't follow. Let's go to Canada or to Europe.
No.
Although Canada is closer. What we've had at different times in this country is a notion that the prosperity we have, we only have because we're all here. And if you look at just the built infrastructure, we've got about $1 million worth of privately owned as well as publicly owned infrastructure in this country, so that every citizen is nominally a millionaire. The issue is, how do we access those resources and how do we make them work for all of us?
Yes.
And that doesn't have to be a heavily bureaucratic state. That could be a much more entrepreneurial or freedom-based entity, but we have not framed the question so that we can live into a better answer.
I agree. You know, we don't want to be living in a nanny state, but we also don't want to be living in a plutocracy. And I think we're very close to that right now, without even having watched. We're just watching it happen, right?
And even a plutocracy, or even just completely alienated from each other.
Uh huh.
Because even if there is some regard across differences, things can work out, but when there is utter disregard, it becomes barbarian.
It does, yes, and we're seeing this, of course, in the last few years. People's basic instincts are being encouraged to come out. one definition of government is what, you know, what should government be? And the most, one of the most basic interpretations is that government should provide the most benefit to the most people. Right. Right. And I always thought that that was built into most countries' governance process. And I don't think that's the case here anymore, you know?
Well, it's not even the case in Europe, because the protection of property has been the, we got that role for government from Europe. But Europeans have tended to distribute property, but not have as much personal freedom. And they've also had some cataclysmic wars that were ethnic cleansing, every bit as bad or worse than we have in this country. Uh-huh. What we have here, we could have here, is a respect for difference that's even greater than they have in Europe. But we have not been able to leverage that here for the last 30 or 40 years, or maybe 50 years. And that's what I spend my time fretting about. I'm sorry.
No, I think I should interview you sometime. This is fascinating.
So let's cut to music, and then I want to follow up with our closing segment on self-care. What should we play?
I had to slip a Bob Dylan song in there. My music tastes are very, very, very Catholic. small C Catholic. So I was going to throw some classical Baroque music at you, and maybe a piece of jazz, and I talked myself out of it. I still don't know why I didn't put a Joni Mitchell song in there, but nevertheless, Bob Dylan. And again, it comes down to which of the, you know, of your 100 favorite Bob Dylan songs.
Sure.
I love this song. It's got this air of desperation that you're going to hear in the one after it as well, that somehow is perfect for his voice. Nobody's quite sure what he's talking about in this song. The lyrics are, you know, nominally addressed to a mean landlord, but he's a metaphor for something. So let's listen to that.
I'm gonna give you all I got to give. I do hope you can see me there. And I'm the way that you live. I can't see, but I just can't love. destiny. Each other's own special gift. And you know this is true. And if you know, underestimate me, I shall underestimate you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Play Report. Our guest on this episode is Peter Bell. So Peter, the way I like to close out the show, and really in many ways the impetus for doing this show in the first place, was for people to talk about how they've learned to take care of themselves, emotionally, intellectually, physically, how they learn to do it, what they do throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly. What do you do for self-care, physically, emotionally?
Yeah, right. Self-care comes pretty naturally to me. I'm one of the lucky people who was born to be kind of generally happy and content. And I think, you know, a mistake, I'm going to get around to the question in a sec. A mistake some people make, and it may not be deliberate, is that they have to assemble some techniques to find happiness. And, you know, read a book on how you can be happy. And really, happiness comes much more organically rather than... Go ahead.
Can I just jump in here for a second? You're not intellectualizing self-care. You are viscerally living it.
Exactly right, yes. And there are other things that I do intellectualize, believe me. But in this case, it has to kind of become spontaneous. And I'm talking from a position of strength here, because I know a lot of people who are not.
And that's the difference between self-care and hedonism.
Yes, they're not. I mean, there's maybe in the Venn diagram, there's a bit of an overlap, but they're not, certainly not the same thing. So, you know, more specifically, what do I do to care for myself? I'm naturally skinny, so I keep my weight down, but that just comes from my metabolism. And I try to sleep well. I need to read a lot for happiness and contentment. I need some time by myself or with my wife. You know, we're both on the introverted side of the, you know, of the scale. So time with friends, but time alone as well. And then, you know, as you get older, quotidian things like just having dinner together every night, you know, you don't think, I'm experiencing great joy and happiness, but it does bring this kind of contentment, which is, I think, the happiness, a large element of happiness is basically being content and not worrying about things that you can't change and not wanting stuff you don't have.
When did you realize that?
I don't know. It must have come gradually. I've never been someone who is envious of other people's positions, and I'm not an accumulator of things, and I've never ever fallen into the idea that stuff you can buy is going to bring happiness. I know that's not the case, and so I just bypassed that whole thing.
What you describe, though, is a sense that your experience is your experience.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. Enough.
Uh-huh. And, you know, as you get older, you do look back on all the experiences you've accumulated and things you've done. And hopefully those memories will serve you in terms of making you feel like you had a good life. We all have things we've done, especially as teenagers, that we still wish could go away. Right. And, you know, the regrets of things you said to people or things you didn't say or substances you put in your body. You know, the Cher pop song, yeah. If I Could Turn Back Time.
Right.
We all want to do that once in a while.
Right. But I think also I work with a number of people in their late 80s and early 90s. And the life review process is much, much easier when there is a sense, when they have, they are content and even accepting of their failures.
Because yeah.
We're not going to be free of failures.
I know. And that's a thing. I guess I'm still struggling with that only in the middle of the night when I wake up. I'm not an insomniac, but when I'm lying in bed, those failures or dumb things I did. I was rude and mean to some of my high school teachers. And at the time it felt empowering to do that. But of course, as I got older, I thought what an idiotic, immature set of actions. But you have to say that that's what happened. At least I grew out of it, right?
Right. And you know, I'm going to say something which is going to sound maybe privileged or arrogant, but unless you know how to be an ass, you don't know how to be sweet.
That's true. And I would also add to that, and I've been around people who exhibited behaviors that I found abhorrent, and just watching them that way made it clear to me I didn't want to be that way. So not me being an ass, but other people being asses. Right. And right. You could see how toxic that is.
And I think that, but there's something about if you don't know your capacity to hurt, you don't know how to be truly kind.
Absolutely.
Because that you're not just being polite. Because people who don't know the negative side can be polite, and it has some of the appearances of kindness, but it lacks the guts.
I agree fully. Very good statement. I'll take that as my own idea, even though it's yours.
What have you learned about your self-care that has surprised you in these last 5 or 10 years? Because you're in an age where that's happening.
Yeah. Well, self-care means different things, you know, during different times of your life.
You know, sleeping when you got a small baby, for example.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, this is going to sound a little funny, but the act of getting hearing aids earlier this year, I spent $7,000 on a state-of-the-art set pair of hearing aids because both sides of my family have, you know, hearing loss, progressive hearing loss as we get older. And I didn't really realize it, but I was getting cranky and I was not paying attention to conversations because I couldn't hear people and I was accusing people of mumbling. And my social skills were diminishing and maybe my happiness quotient was going down a little bit, all because of these hearing aids that I didn't have in my ears. The minute I got them, I became a much better person internally, and I expect kind of to other people as well. And the funny thing is my grandmother became deaf, my mother's mother, in her 40s. She would be 127 years old if she were alive today. But you know, she had very rudimentary hearing aids, but they just didn't do anything. And you think of Beethoven, what would his life have been with modern technology? How much more could he have done? So simple things like that, you know, we're living in an era where self-care in regard to, you know, helping your senses work better is pretty obvious.
But I think what you said was so critical, because the people I work with oftentimes do not realize that they are blaming others for a condition that they need to address in themselves. And you're addressing it as a witness and a testimony to that responsibility that just needs to be heard.
Yeah.
It happens with hearing, it can happen with vision. It happens with capacity to walk. It happens with driving. All of these things are core pieces of being an adult, and they change when you get older.
Yes, they do. Hey, this is great. I thought we'd spend the whole time talking about wine, and I'm happy not to, but ideas I'm getting out of you.
Well, this is about your humanity more than anything else.
Right.
And I thank you for that. And Peter, we have come to the end of the hour. It has been wonderful to get to know you. Thank you for sharing of your life and your wisdom with me on the show. What would you like to close with it musically?
Well, I'll thank you, Eric, for inviting me on the show. And I have one more piece of music, if you can fit it in. It's by a group called The Band. You know instantly who I'm talking about. I'm not sure if they're as well known to people, younger people, as say the Beatles or the Rolling Stones, probably not, or Led Zeppelin, but certainly a very, very seminal bunch of musicians. They're one of their, again, kind of dark, desperate, non-happy songs is called King Harvest Has Surely Come. Some of the greatest snarly guitar playing. Robbie Robertson's licks are wonderful. Here it is.
And we'll be playing a version recorded in the last waltz. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Carnival on the edge of town. King Harvest is surely come.